Yesterday morning at 6:23 exactly, my colleague Jacob Goldstein sent out an email to the entire Planet Money team. And this email had three letters in it. T-P-P and an exclamation point. And in the body of the email was a link to 6,000 pages of a trade deal. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, was finally here. To understand how big a deal this is, it affects 12 countries around the Pacific Rim, the US, Canada, Vietnam, Japan, a bunch of others, and it sets the rules for more than a third of the world's trade. And until yesterday, the details were secret. People had been arguing about it for years, upset at what they assumed was inside, but finally we got the whole text. And for Planet Money, this was like Christmas morning, because finally we could dig in and find out what was really inside. Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Robert Smith. Today on the show, the trade deal that will define the world we live in. Inside this trade deal are lines of text that will affect your life, all of our lives, for decades to come. I'm going to be honest with you, we had a different show scheduled for today, but we postponed it. We gave every reporter at Planet Money the old magnifying glass, the red pen, and one day, 24 hours to pour through the documents. Their assignment, find us something fascinating about the trade deal. 6,000 pages. How hard could it be?
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Vonage. In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service, making it better. After such a feat, who would have blamed Vonage if they said, enjoy better world, we'll be carving up the ski slopes. But today, Vonage is not on the slopes, shredding the way only Vonage can shred, but is back to work, transforming communications for your business with award-winning cloud-based solutions. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Deal, is huge for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, it's been this sort of secret negotiation. It's been going on for years and years and years and years. And it's this trade deal that basically regulates all forms of how these countries, these 12 countries around the Pacific Rim, interact. Now, up until yesterday, we were in sort of phase one. Negotiators from all the different countries were determining what they were willing to compromise on and what they really wanted. Now we begin phase two. Everyone reads the details, and the various legislatures of the various countries, like the U.S. Congress, decides, is this a deal we want to sign on to? Do we want to pass this? Now, at its very basic core, at its skeleton, is what we refer to as sort of a basic trade deal, which is it deals with tariffs. Tariffs are taxes. When you try to import or export an item, that's what a tariff is. And a traditional trade deal tries to lower those tariffs. That's what people think of when they say free trade. So first up, dealing with one of these items, Jacob Goldstein.
Hi, Robert.
Hey.
So, Robert, I dove in to Chapter 2, Annex 2D.
And I will tell people that all day long yesterday, Jacob was hunched over his computer. His eyes were 2 inches from the screen, peering down in what looked like a very detailed Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, so this section, there's actually spreadsheet after spreadsheet, like multiple spreadsheets for each country. The one I dove into is called, let me just get it right, it's called the U.S. Tariff Elimination Schedule, which is what it sounds like. And that one alone is hundreds of pages, thousands of items. Here, I printed out just the first page. Just read like the first line.
All right. The first line, there's a number and it says live purebred breeding horses and asses.
Yeah, and then just keep going.
Asses in the first line. Live horses other than purebred breeding horses. Live asses other than purebred breeding asses.
Right. So it's hundreds of pages of this of just like every single thing you can imagine.
That
and
exists.
Then permutations. Yeah, basically each item in the world is sort of itemized here. And it tells you what the tariff is now and how it'll change for each country. So I was imagining yesterday as I was going through this, like imagining, you know, in Washington and in businesses all around the country, people are looking for their one line. You know, you're a business, you got the one line in this whole giant thing that you've been fighting for that's going to make the difference for your business. And so finally last night, I got somebody on the phone. I talked to one of these people who's obsessed with one line. His name is Casey Walsh.
You know, the critical code for us is 6401-9910.
Six, and do you know that one by heart? Did you just give that to me off the top of your head?
I've been paying attention to this bill. So yeah, I do know that one by heart.
So Casey Walsh owns a company called Sims Fishing Products. They have a factory in Bozeman, Montana, town close to my heart. I used to live there. And they make fancy fishing waders, you know, like...
Like those plastic things that, like, fly fishermen
yeah,
wear when they go out?
Yeah, maybe they're rubber. I don't know. I'm not a fly fisherman, to be honest with you. But so this code covers at least some of the waders they sell. And you can find it on page 169, one of these tiny little lines in this part of the TPP. And this line tells us that right now, the basic tariff, if you import waders, is 37.5%.
37.5% is a tax on foreign waders.
Very good.
So that protects the United States
Wader
industry.
That protects Casey Walsh. Well, yeah, the United States wader industry, as far as I can tell, is basically this one guy,
Casey Walsh.
And his company, which does employ, you know, it employs some number of people in Bozeman to make waders. And if you read over this same line, it tells us that if TPP passes, this tariff is not going to go away immediately. It has this special code there. And that code means that if TPP passes, the tariff will remain in place for another 8 years after TPP goes into effect. And then it'll be phased out for several years after that. I asked Casey about this long phase out. That delay, is that basically there for you, for your company?
Well, I hope so.
So Casey Walsh told
me. Did he ask for it?
Yeah, he you know, he talked to his congressman, he talked to the trade representative, he talked to the lobbyist who represents his industry group, over this one little line.
And so for the next several years, everybody in this country who buys foreign waders will basically be paying a tax for you, right?
Well, I like to think about it, Jacob, as, you know, we're providing jobs in the U.S., I'm sure there are numerous examples of this with similar manufacturers.
Oh, sure. I mean, thousands of pages, right? I'm sure every line in the thing has a story like this when you're just the guy I happen to find.
Right.
Now, Robert, I should say, I followed up with Casey today, and he's had a chance to, like, digest this a little more. And he said there is actually this other line in the TPP, another part of the tariff code that affects a lot of the waders he sells. And under the TPP, the tariff on those waders is going to go away immediately when TPP is passed. So that means right then he'll, you know, have no protection from foreign competitors.
It is fascinating that someone who is, I was going to say knee deep, but that's a terrible pun, who is knee deep in waders is still figuring out, is this on the whole good or on the whole bad for him?
Yeah, I could really feel that in talking to him, frankly, as he's sort of working through it all. And bottom line, on balance, he said he is for TPP. He thinks it's going to be good for his business. There are a few reasons for this. One of them that I found interesting is, as part of TPP, Japan is lowering its tariff on imported waders. And, you know, so Casey Walsh is hoping he can sell more of these waders that people are making in Bozeman, Montana, to fishermen in Japan.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks, Robert.
It's interesting sort of flipping through the TPP trade agreement because you can see these sort of deep needs and desires that each country has. Canada really wants to cut the tariffs on beef. They have these cattle. They want to ship it to the United States. They want those tariffs down. Japan, they want to cut tariffs on auto parts. Each country has this thing that they want, that they traded everything else for. And what did the United States want? Steve Henn is in Silicon Valley. Why don't you read us a little bit of the TPP?
Okay. The key provision is Article 18.63, Term of Protection for Copyright and Related Rights. Part A, on the basis of the life of a natural person, the term shall be not less than the life of the author and 70 years after the author's death.
Whoa, explain that to me.
This language is designed to protect some of America's biggest exports. It's meant to protect this guy.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Mickey Mouse.
Is that the Mickey Mouse voice?
That's the new Mickey Mouse voice. That's Mickey Mouse on the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. And, you know, Mickey is part of a $500 billion industry, the film business. TV and entertainment is a huge American export. So what this thing does, what this language does, is it guarantees that Disney owns the rights to Mickey Mouse exclusively for 70 years after the death of Walt Disney.
And not just Mickey Mouse.
It's every artistic work, every piece of music that's copyrighted, every film, every book, software.
70 years seems amazingly long. What is it now in these countries?
Well, in many of these countries, it was 50 years after the death of the author. So this is a big extension, and it's pretty controversial. There were lots of critics.
My name's Jeremy Malcolm. I work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we fight threats to digital rights around the world.
Now, Malcolm thinks extending copyrights this way makes almost no sense.
There's simply no rhyme or reason for some of these things. The extension of copyright term by another 20 years is something that any economist will tell you makes no sense whatsoever.
But why not? I mean, if I, as an artist, invest time and effort in creating something and it's a hit and I die, I want my children, maybe even my grandchildren, to benefit from that.
You may want that for your children and grandchildren, but the public also wants to be able to use works from long ago as part of the public domain, which is free for everyone.
Now, Steve, the United States has been enormously successful in software and in music and in film, and we have this 70 years protection. So couldn't you argue that this, in fact, helps the creation of new content in the world?
Yeah, and that's exactly the argument that music producers and the motion picture industry make. But the United States also has other provisions in its law that sort of balance out these protections. You know, for example, we played Mickey Mouse earlier in this podcast, and we're able to do that because of a part of U.S. law called fair use. So it allows other people to comment on creative works, to criticize them, to satirize them, to use them in news broadcasts. And many other countries around the world don't have these kinds of fair use protections. So Malcolm says if you export only part of the U.S. law, you get a really one-sided intellectual property rights system that tilts completely in the balance of big rights holders like Disney or record studios.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
That's fair use, Disney. Fair use. In many ways, the stuff we've talked about so far is pretty standard for a trade agreement. But what makes the TPP notable is how much other stuff has been shoved into those 6,000 pages. Things you wouldn't normally think about as a part of trade. For instance, a big point of controversy in the agreement is often referred to by opponents as the secret foreign tribunals.
But they're not actually technically secret. They're secretive, though. That gets used a lot.
Ladies and gentlemen, Stacey Vanek-Smith, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Robert.
Now, which part did we give you?
Chapter 28 of the TPP, entitled Dispute Settlement.
So you got it easy. This is only like 30 pages.
Yeah, it was really easy to deal with. But basically, this sets up a whole justice system for the TPP. The TPP basically has its own little mini justice system to deal with disputes between companies and countries in the TPP.
So how does this thing work?
So it's not exactly a court system. The tribunals are three judges that get appointed by the people in the case. And the kinds of cases are, for instance, let's say there's a company in the U.S. and it has a factory in Canada. Canada's in the TPP. And Canada, for some reason, decides to seize the factory.
To raise the maple leaf above it?
To raise the maple leaf above it. The U.S. company can go to an international tribunal and say, hey, this is wrong. You can't do this.
And then the tribunal could kick Canada out of the TPP. So you don't get any of the benefits of trade anymore. And of course, the benefits of trade are enormous to Canada. And so this is a disincentive for Canada to take away factories.
Yes. And I talked to Todd Weiler. He's a lawyer, and he has worked in international treaty arbitration for almost 20 years. He's dealt with a lot of these cases under NAFTA, the last big trade agreement we were in. And he says in his experience, this has been a good system. It doesn't get used all that often, but when it does, it works pretty well.
There's maybe been three dozen disputes under the NAFTA in over 20 years. So it's not really a big deal. Instead, it basically helps instill the rule of law both locally and at the international level.
Now, this all sounds okay when we're talking about something really egregious like taking someone's factory, but it's been used for much smaller slights.
Well, exactly. I mean, under this system, a company can dispute anything a country does that interferes with its profits. So in this really famous case, Philip Morris has gone after Uruguay because Uruguay launched a big anti-smoking campaign. And Philip Morris basically said, this has interfered with our profits and our investment in your country, and you have to stop doing this.
And they brought one of these cases?
Yes.
And has the tribunal decided?
No, it's still going on. And I ran this by Todd Weiler to ask him about this, and this is what he said.
For people who defend this system, who think it's a good system, the worst case scenario is a tobacco company getting involved.
He kept stressing that this was an exception. And in fact, he pointed me to something in the TPP, which is right here, Chapter 29, Exceptions and General Provisions. And they have actually, Article 29.5, created an exception for tobacco companies.
Basically say, you are so evil, you're not allowed to use this tribunal system.
Yes.
But, you know, it is easy to imagine a scenario under which whatever the thing you care about, let's say environmental rules in the United States, you want to preserve forests, but there's some company that says, oh, your environmental rules hurt my profit. You can imagine them taking the United States and its environmental rules to this tribunal, and you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, this is the big worry about these tribunals, is that basically big, rich companies could use an international tribunal potentially to challenge laws that have been put in place to protect the environment or public health or something that interferes with that company's profits.
Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, Robert.
Finally today, Mr. David Kestenbaum with not something inside the TPP, but something that he noticed was perhaps not inside the TPP.
This is called the secret tariff.
The secret tariff.
Yeah, yeah. The TPP goes into all this detail on, like, catfish, sneakers, french fries, donkeys, sturgeon roe, some types of gauze.
Gauze?
Just some types. It's on and on, right? But there is this secret way that countries can easily apply a tariff to every single thing coming into their country.
Which is?
Currency manipulation.
Now, I have to say, I travel the world, and yet currency still, like, makes my head hurt. Explain to me how the value of someone else's currency affects what I buy and the price of what I buy.
All right. So if you are Ford Motor Company, you are making sedans, very nice sedans, the Ford Focus. You want to export those to Japan, right? You make them in the United States. They cost you a certain amount in dollars to make them. Then you export them to Japan. They're going to sell in the local currency. So basically, you have to take the dollars that it took to make that, convert it to Japanese yen. So if Japan weakens its yen, it takes a lot of yen to buy $1, then the price in yen of your car in Japan is going to go up.
So functionally, nothing has changed about the Ford Motor Company or the car itself.
And there's no explicit tariff.
Yeah, but overnight, you could go to the car lot in Tokyo and say, whoa, these American cars are so expensive. What happened?
Yeah, and when you compare it to local goods made in that country, they don't have that tariff. Here's Steve Vegan. He's vice president for governmental affairs at Ford Motor Company.
There's just no way you can compete head-to-head with competitors that have that kind of built-in advantage provided by their government.
He calls currency manipulation the mother of all trade barriers.
So they spent all this time arguing about one percentage point here and one percentage point there about the tax that would be on cars and horses and all these things.
Yeah, but there's this other big thing out there, right? My question was, has this ever actually happened? Have we signed a big trade deal and then one of the countries went and manipulated its currencies? So I called up Adam Posen. He runs the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And I said, give me an example of this. And he said, okay, Korea.
Korea and U.S. negotiated a free trade agreement between them a few years ago, and the Koreans then proceeded to very aggressively intervene against the dollar.
Currency manipulation. They made their currency weaker, and it made all American goods there instantly more expensive. So this did happen with Korea.
Absolutely.
And how much did they manipulate their currency by? What do we think? What percent?
Well, probably on the order of 15%, but only for a limited period. The problem is the timing really was pretty obnoxious.
It was right after we signed the trade deal with them.
That is so obnoxious.
Yeah, it's a real problem, right? Farmers get really upset about this.
Because they're doing this basic product. If you're selling wheat to Indonesia, say, the currency exchange rate can make your wheat suddenly, like, totally unaffordable.
You're something that's perishable. Then, like, it's got to go out this week. You know, you can't just kind of sit on it. So I called up Roger Johnson, the head of the National Farmers Union. Do you want to know what he had for lunch? We always ask that when we start
recording. Sure, tell me.
Actually, I had homemade pork chops and potatoes and peas. It was pretty good.
Farmer through and through.
It is awesome to be a farmer.
Anyway, I asked Roger to read the part of the TPP that deals with currency manipulation. Where is this in the TPP? What page
currency
is it on?
Currency manipulation?
Yeah.
Good question. Nowhere. That's the problem.
I thought it was in there. I was trying to find it. I didn't set him up. It turns out there is a side agreement. The U.S. Treasury Department signed this agreement with the other countries. And Roger says the language in that is pretty good.
Let's see. Each of the 12 will, quote, refrain from competitive devaluation and will not target its country's exchange rate for competitive purposes, end quote.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, his problem with it is that that's sort of all it says. It says we're going to get together once a year and talk about how we all feel about it. You know, it's not like you get kicked out of the TPP if you manipulate your currency or you get dragged before some international court or something. So when it comes time for Congress to decide whether or not to approve the TPP, Roger says the Farmers Union thinks they should vote no, and Ford Motor Company is also saying vote no.
I want to ask you one big question here at the end. How does something like the TPP pass, seeing as somewhere in thousands and thousands of pages, there is something for everyone to hate?
There's also something for everyone to love.
So it's just whether you have more love than hate.
Yeah, for Adam Posen, the economist we talked to, like, he has way more love for this than hate. He likes it. It's good for the United States, and on the whole, it's going to be good for other countries as well.
We only had 24 hours, and so we barely made a dent in the TPP. If you would like to go out and read some and let us know what you find, for good, for bad, for interesting, you can email us, planetmoney@npr.org. We're on Facebook, or, you know, you can do this on Instagram. I'm at Radio Smith on Instagram, and look, I've been Instagramming the TPP.
What does it say? Carcasses and half carcasses, other cuts with bones in, meat of goats?
Meat of goats!
Everything's in there. Our episode today was a Full Court Press. It's produced by Alex Goldmark here, Kristen Clark, Jess Jang, and Nick Fountain. Thank you, everybody. Special thanks to our intern, Sindhu Nyanasambandam.
And Quinn O'York of Lacrosse Footwear, Ron Serini of Serini, Samet & Associates, and...
Also thanks to the fellows at the Townite Center at the City University of New York.
If you want to check out another show from NPR, please try Pop Culture Happy Hour. This week, they talk with J.K. Rowling.
Rhymes with bowling, it says.
It says rhymes with bowling. Because everyone says Rowling, but J.K. Rowling is the guest. Pop Culture Happy Hour. Listen now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. I'm Robert Smith.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Thanks for listening.